We have Mary Lynn talking about sustaining minoritised languages of Europe.
Yes. Thank you very much, and I also want to thank the Hawaiian people for the land that we're on, and for the ICLDC committee for accepting this paper, taking a chance. So basically, I want to give you an overview of a research project that I've been working on for a couple of years since I came in 2014 to the Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian. And it's called Sustaining Minoritized Languages of Europe. And it's really conducting community-situated ethnographic and social linguistic research to create in-depth case studies around a series of research questions addressing the social, cultural, political, and economic factors that contribute to the increased vitality of minority language communities. So that's a lot. There definitely are case studies out there, but we are really interested in looking at the ethnography of language revitalization, what really makes people get interested and sustain their languages. So we have a website, and so I don't have to go back, toggle back and forth. If you go to folklife.si.edu/smile, you get to our homepage. And our research questions are right down there. They're downloadable. So we won't have time to go over all the research questions that the case studies are built around, but they're all there and ready for you to look at there. So a little bit of background. The Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage has three branches to it. The Smithsonian Folklife Festival, which is every year except for this year, thank you, government shutdown. Since 1967, when the Smithsonian wanted to open the doors to the people, get the instruments out of the cases and to be played. And of course, 67, 68 was a wonderful year for culture of, for and by the people, right? And we have been doing it every year, at least once a year. And we've always had language as a component, even from the beginning part. People are encouraged to present, self-represent their culture in their languages, and we have interpreters to help them interact so they don't have to have a majority language to talk to people going to the Folklife Festival. In 2009, one example, just Wales, we had language teaching available for people who wanted to learn a bit of Welsh and stuff. So it's not unusual that we have language in our center. We also are known for Folkways recordings. And more recently, a research branch in cultural sustainability, and I was hired into that part of it. And you might think of why folklore and endangered languages. I think the last wonderful presentation actually quoted Noyes as well. But folklore has been, it's really actually a good home. I've been in anthropology departments and linguistics departments, and I feel very at home in folklore. The concept of group, so tearing down who, you know, trying to think of what a community is or how to deal with speech community, all these things, they pretty much went to group a long time ago and a self-identified group of people. They work with tangible and intangible cultural heritage, so in knowledge, religious, language fall under intangible cultural heritage. Also an emphasis on expressive culture as well, which linguistics falls really well into. There's always this inherent, we saw it in the last talk as well, tension between old and new representations and how to keep heritage alive in that way. Folklore really hasn't had, always had an emphasis on community-driven research, on community self-present representation and presentations by the community. It's also empowering of people often associated with social movements, and again, the motto of our department is culture by, for, and of the people. So it's a good fit. The CFCH strategic plan, language is vital to cultural diversity, it's vital to cultural transmission and sustainability, and it underlies issues in migration and immigration, which is a large research component in the CFCH, so, and across the Smithsonian. The funding for this project comes from Ferring Pharmaceuticals, and this is important. Not just to give him credit, but Frederick Carl Paulsen is a Swedish citizen, but his roots go into Fur, a Frisian-speaking island that is now in Germany. And his grandfather was a fluent Frisian speaker. He is not, and is therefore interested in language revitalization. He also funded the Folklife Festival 2013 that focused on endangered languages, Festival One World, Many Voices. And the website has a lot of really nice materials available to the public from that program. Some of the initial parameters, as a funder, he did have parameters on the money. It needed to be situated in Europe, thus the person who had worked in Oklahoma all of her life found herself in Western Europe. Not a bad food choice, but his board wanted it around case studies, which wouldn't have been my first choice, but we work within that parameter. And there needed to be practical applications to it, and that was actually Dr. Paulson's, which is good. That's how I would prefer to work as well. So my initial questions in coming in and giving these parameters and inheriting this project was that I was really interested in, Western Europe has a fairly long trajectory of language revitalization. Some programs, some efforts go back to the turn of last century, and definitely from 1968 in Europe as well, with cultural revolutions that were going on, and also some political revolutions going on. There was a real jump in trajectory for languages at that time. So a little bit longer trajectory than some of the programs that I was familiar with in the United States. And so I was really interested in kind of in the trajectory of these. What are the internal, external, positive triggers for reversing language shift? And how do programs or efforts or communities sustain and build on those? How do language workers move from the individual interest to a group, to maybe a larger community-wide effort as well? How do they work through some of these really important issues that can really tear apart programs at times, such as authority in making decisions, such as incorporating new speakers? And I'm using the term new speakers. That is a European term that is pretty widely accepted there, so I will use it. And they have great definitions. There's a really wonderful website by Bernie O'Rourke that you should look at. And then also the interest of the CFCH is really how does language revitalization interact with music, traditional arts, wellness, healing, and life ways, and vice versa. So knowing that I didn't know anything about Europe, we had an international workshop in Barcelona, Spain, where we invited a lot of people who had been working in their communities or across communities for quite a few years. And so we looked at some initial questions. I went to Lenore Grenoble and Karen Rice and Misty Jaffe to ask some initial questions about how to work in Europe. And so we all went over to Barcelona, and we invited other people to come along, and we came up with some more richer questions for building case studies. But first we had to find some common terminology. It was really interesting the way I was talking from language revitalization to the terminology that's used in Europe. One of them is that I inherited the term Meyer-Nord. I inherited smile too. I call it grimace with a small I. I didn't make the acronym. But once we had the acronym, I was kind of stuck with it. But minority definitely would cover languages like Polish in Ireland, which is the second largest language in Ireland. So the Europeans really preferred minoritized because they have been put into a minority situation. There was also indigenous versus autochthonous. I won't get into much here, but most of the groups that we worked with preferred the term autochthonous, but that is not the case. A lot of Welsh people preferred indigenous as well. Sami prefer indigenous. So we had to kind of figure out who we were talking about in all of this. Vitality versus status. I use vitality to mean living and the really positive things that are going on in reversing language shift. And for most of them, it simply meant status. So they were really confused. Why do you want to look at the status of these languages? It's like, no, that's not what we want. And then language versus dialect, which is a problem everywhere. But the European Union designates languages for dialects do not receive funding, so people were worried about who would be eligible for funding. And then success, what we weren't wanting to determine success of programs. We were just looking at how people continued and what they considered nice jumps in vitality. And this working definition, Leanne and I talked about this earlier this year as well, but success is defined as increased engagement with the language in a community. And for this project, some sustained increased engagement too, because we're trying to look a little bit diachronically across time since we can get that data in these cases. We ended up with a board as well. So here they are. We have Europeans and some of us non-Europeans as well on it. And so we put out a call for research proposals. And I also went to a couple to give informational talks at a couple European conferences, because it's a strange thing. We're asking people to build this case study but we're actually asking the specific questions. So it's a weird type of research award. We received 23 qualified proposals. The advisory board nominated 6 to move forward to be funded with 2 alternatives, but all 6 accepted. And it was based on the quality of the proposal and a balance of different areas, languages, and types of communities and programs. So the research goals, again, just real quickly, kind of worked out with is to build this in-depth case study that reveals the trajectory of the community's language program. That's where we get these kind of triggers. You know, what really boosted you forward, and how long did that last, or how did it spread out? To analyze the language maintenance programs or efforts, how they respond, how the people and the programs respond to internal and external factors. And then to explore those relationships between other parts of the culture and language revitalization. So we'll look a little bit at the research questions, but each case study, they needed to answer all the questions for it. The questions could be interpreted or modified for each community, but they needed to answer all of them. We have a section F, which is really left open for things that really weren't in our questions that was very important to those communities. So we left leeway in there. And that they really needed to work in an ethnographic methodology, combine participant observation, consultation, interviews, plus literature and archival research. So a lot of these efforts have been going for a long time, and they had good internal documentation, so we needed to be able to tap into those as well. So this is a background note on comparability. You know, technically, these case studies aren't comparable. We've always said that, like, one of the problems with being able to compare, to learn from each other, is that each community, each culture is really different, so it's not really comparable across. But we wanted to kind of throw that idea out, that yes, we have a lot to learn from each other, and we're far enough along that we can definitely learn from each other. And on the opposite end, we can't just wait till we have, like, very, very two comparable case studies with the same amount of, you know, size of population and all this stuff. Otherwise, we'd never be looking across. So in strict terms, they're not comparable. They're all Western Europe. That is comparable. They're all from different countries with different policies and histories. And we do have one that has a Soviet era history, which not surprisingly is patterning very different than the other. We've tried to have all have at least efforts since 1968, but a few of them had really good applications. They've never had continuous efforts, but jump starts here and there. So we're kind of interested in looking at the questions in that light as well. So we accepted these. And the community size really affects the quality of the data. The questions were really made for smaller groups, efforts, programs, and one group really tried, the Occitan group was looking very large at the all Occitania, which is really big, and they've since focused around the Toulouse area. So the team makeups, that we requested that at least 2 PIs and 1 preferably from the community, we got that all except for 1 case study. They need to have, because the money was only for 18 months, they must have a prior relationship with the community in order to really kind of hit the ground running and really fall back on some of their prior research. They must have a history of working community-based, you know, with that community. And we wanted them interdisciplinary, and we really got that as well. We have linguists, social linguists, we have education. We have people who have focused on economy with cultural revitalization, and people who have worked in policy, and a journalist. So, and needed to be willing to collaborate, not just in the community, but with the other research teams and with the advisory board. And this is a really kind of a shock for some of these researchers. They've never been asked to collaborate in that way before. This is, again, a background part with the concept of community, where we really let them determine what that was. So any group that was making a sustained effort, it includes grassroots organizations, specific educational cultural programs, villages, towns. We really didn't want, like, Ireland. We didn't want that. Really community-driven efforts, even if they were iterations of state policies, and in that case, our Irish is a really good example of that. But could interact with state or top-down policies. So we've met a couple times, and we'll talk about the teams in a minute. So we've gotten together on an initial workshop, and then we had a midpoint workshop in Galway, and that these are the teams there, and we will meet for the last time on the Isle of Fir, and yes, Farian is paying for that, in the cultural center he built, where we're really going to spend a week in really looking at our data together and outlining, you know, what we're finding and these kinds of things. We also have a Google Docs that we work with together as well. The research questions fall in this area. And the first section is really what most people would traditionally think of as a case study, is really kind of giving a snapshot of the history of the program, and just different plotting along a timeline. And then there's a section on attitudes, transmission and lifelong learning, support and infrastructure that includes a lot of the economics. You know, are there awards for, you know, are there paying jobs for speaking your language? You know, these kinds of things. Responses to new media, domains and speakers, and then the further questions. So those are the large, if we have time, after this, I'll go into the actual research questions. So here are the teams and the communities. We have Irish, Gaelic, and these are from the University of Maryland, and they're not really adequate for this, but we're actually working with Cuaca Guane, which is down here on the Dingle Peninsula. It's a very small community. They pride themselves in saying that they speak Irish even in the winter when the tourists are gone. And they do. I've been there. It's really amazing. But they're literally right at the margin. The water is right there. They can't go, you know, anyway. So here's the Irish team. They have an individual strength but from the PIs in family language policy, which we would call just family language learning. Cassie Smith Christmas was actually a student of Jack Martin's at College of William and Mary. She did her dissertation work in Scotland. She embedded with the family for several years and was watching the intergenerational transmission, and then has moved down to Ireland and here. I've marked the PIs in red that are from the community in question. So the community workers that are on it are linguists, and GR Mary Burke is a graduate student as well. So, they're looking at a program that in this town of Guine, which is started by actually an archaeological dig, and the community wanted control over the findings from that and the artifacts from that dig, and has since reached out. They work with the school and now with language, so it's worked. It's gone out from there. It's an amazing program. North Frisian, and no, we. They had a very competitive application. Everybody wonders, but it was competitive. So anyway, we're actually looking up in here in the Fir area by chance. Really, believe me, competitive. So so here's their title, very long title. But they have a long history of revitalization in this area as well. We can also look at the macro variations, not from the Danish to the Dutch Frisian programs, but from the island to the mainland, which is a very big difference. The mainland is not doing well with language retention at all. And again, three PIs, Nils is an education person, and Femi and Lena are linguists that are also Frisian and actually cut their chops in Peru. They've done work in Peru. Upper and lower Sorbian, so sorry, this one, there's, but actually both of this. This is the upper Sorbian, this is the lower Sorbian. So in the eastern part of Germany, almost to Poland. And this team is really looking at the differences. The upper Sorbian is Catholic and have really a lot of language. The lower Sorbian are Protestant and do not have any younger speakers. And this is part of the SMILE workshop. They're working with some of the younger Sorbians and from lower Sorbia that are interested in learning their language and language revitalization. And Cordula and Nicole, Cordula is the journalist that's on the team. Occitan, that's all of France, but I've tried to mark with a very big area, Toulouse. I'm not very good at doing that, but anyway, I'm not a map maker. And this is the only team that doesn't have an Occitanian person on it. But they have a really good track record of working in the community. James Costa has worked there for a long time, and they're really looking at the economic, the pairing of language with economics, and they have a long history of language advocacy from the late 19th century. So they have a pretty long trajectory in there. So Galician, and again, it's a large area. The group that we're working with is right here. They're looking at Semente, which is a grassroots organization very much like Aja Pananaleo. Several families that got together and decided to take control of their children's education in Galician, but also, but also in feminizing the language, anti-capitalism, and a lot of other things. So. And Agrico and Greco, who are in the tip of Greek communities that are in Italy. So I'm just going to have to do this real quickly, sorry. So a couple things have come out already. I'm going to talk about the community impact. And one of them is that the questions, our research questions, the Ordo Jorge Guene decided they really like these questions, and so they're answering them internally as well, besides what they're doing with the workers. And they decided that it's actually giving them a more holistic, by asking the questions about how they're working with their youth, they realized they weren't working with their youth. And so there's been that. The Sorbian group have really analyzed that the lower Sorbians were kept waiting for policies to go from the top down because they had pretty much had to do that during the Soviet era, but there was no top down anymore, so nothing was taking place. So Cordula figured this was a great place to really kind of start working with the attitudes, and they've invited the Semente group, the Galician group, over to visit with them because that's definitely a grassroots. So that kind of connection is good. The Grico and Greco group are about 5 hours apart by treacherous driving, which I'm going to have to do in a few weeks, and I'm really scared about it. They haven't been communicating for many, many years, and they are now, and they're working back and forth and getting inspiration from each other. So that's a really amazing part. And then just these new connections. Most of the communities want to meet with the other communities that are in this project, and they're interested in this comparative data, which is kind of fun. So right now we have the SMILE website, which is actually the first, believe it or not, bilingual, and it is in this case multilingual, website for the Smithsonian.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's rather depressing, right, that it wasn't okay. Okay, so, you know, and that really helps each of these communities as well. So that's nice. We asked all of our teams to produce at least one blog to make what their research is available to other people. So we have this nice feeding of blogs. So like this is the Sorbian website. So if you see up here, you can if you click on one of those, you can read all of it, including we translated all this word as well. So it's a completely bilingual website in either upper or lower Sorbian. And here you can see Cordula's blog available right there as well. So academic products, we do plan on having an edited volume, conference talks and things like this. And we're looking for a way that all the case studies can be made available. And then archiving, we're archiving in Dans in the Netherlands, a full set, all of it in Dans. And the Ralph Rinzler archives, those are the ones at CFCH, that we'll have to have more information redacted for to follow EU standards of right now. So. And then each team in their application was asked to identify and deposit a copy in one local archive, and they could identify how that local would be interpreted. So anyway, I want to thank you very much. And I went over time.
Any questions?
Is there any particular reason why all the projects were in Western Europe as opposed to Southern and Eastern Europe?
Yes. We didn't get any further east than Sorbian. Actually, we did. But politically, they had to pull out. We had one from Crimea, and it was good. But anyway, they couldn't do that. So the rest of it, no. I mean, we got there was a real drop off, after about the 8. In quality and being prepared to really do this kind of work in 18 months. So that was the main reason. We did have some more, I mean, we wanted some, and I like tapped people like, don't you guys want to apply? But we didn't really, I mean, this is really what the best proposals were. So that's it.
Can I ask why your board is so American?
Yes, you can. because we needed a small board to be kind of functional. I'm trying to get back to the board. So we have Nils, who is Sami, and we have Carme, who is Catalonian, and we have Ty, who is Irish. And yes, the rest of us are American. Part of that was invitations of people who wanted to work on it and be a part of it. Part of it was, and like Misty, who passed in November, has worked in Corsica for many, many years. She was really good. I mean, she was really good at being able to teach all of the linguists and people in here ethnography. So we really used her for that. And, you know, so to me, that she was invaluable for that. And she's really well known and well loved in Europe. So, yes, she's American, it was hard to tell that. But yeah, and Lenore and Karen were there. They were there for me, so we kept them on the board. And again, it's been really invaluable to have both of their perspectives, because we want this data to be useful not just in Europe but across. So in developing the questions, especially what were in other areas of the world, especially Lenore's work in Russia and stuff was really helpful. So some of the board members are the director, you know, for the CFCH, so, you know, he's titular.
Yep.
Sebastian?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's an interesting project, and your perspective on it is quite interesting as well. You could feel that you think you are addressing a non-European audience, because you said also the Europeans.
Well, you know, people don't think of me as working in Europe at all, so, I mean, mean, it is really, Nick was saying, this would be really interesting.
Yeah, for the first time, I think I felt a little bit like a native. But that's mm-hmm. also, although it doesn't go to the...
But I definitely project. Can't say we. I mean, I'm not European.
Yeah, well,
so.
Anyway, just a joke. Mm-hmm. But it is an interesting point, because you also mentioned at the beginning that there is different terminologies and so forth. And I just came across 2 weeks ago or so from a fellow documentary linguist, a retired professor from Vienna, who wrote a letter to the UN general to protest against the International Year of Indigenous Languages, because indigenous is, at least in some parts of Europe, a completely unacceptable term. And he was reporting on Africa, where he had very strong reactions against that, and said that the same holds for parts of Australia and so forth. Of course, you have in North America, you have First Nations and so forth.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And nevertheless, the UN has just the word indigenous, and for me, it didn't sound strange at all first.
Mm-hmm.
So in Brazil, it is linguas indigenous, and that's it. There is just no other term. So
right.
If it is colonialist and whatever, I don't know. I just wanted to throw that back to you, that there's really
right.
Interesting.
We had some in the initial larger workshop where we invited a lot of people, you know, that you probably recognized many of them in the picture. We had especially the Basque representatives that were there really didn't like the word indigenous. They preferred autochthonous.
Yeah.
And then the Sami, what you know, wanted indigenous. So we got around it, but in that they could self-identify in the case studies. But for our term, minoritized was what we would use. I like the term actually, and I've and a lot of people in North America weren't familiar with the term. It gets away from endangered language community even. It's a word that they preferred, and so we definitely used it. I was kind of hoping to break so I could get rid of the SMILE acronym, but they.
Okay, one last question.
So I know that you said that these aren't comparable, obviously, and you're doing case studies, but I wonder if mm-hmm. when you're kind of pulling them all together, if there's going to be an attempt to kind of address themes or like an...
Yes, definitely. That's one of the things we're finding. I mean, the case studies are going to be able to be used for a lot of different purposes, and they will be open to the public. So we don't really know what the shape of the final one is. We do know that each team their chapter can be what they want to address in this. So it doesn't have to be all of the findings together, but we're not quite sure how it's going to shape up. The other thing is I didn't mention is that each team is presenting their findings in the community. So I'm visiting all of the sites, and in several of the cases, I'm visiting at the time that they're presenting the majority of their findings, and I'm there to, you know, kind of be the cheerleader for their language work and things like that. Not the teams, but the whole, you know, groups. So the communities are really interested in this, which is, you know, usually not so interested in more academic approaches. So I'm really pleased that they're taking an interest. So we'll probably find out from some of these also stuff that they would like to do with some of these materials. And we have some funding that can help them do that and also to stay connected. So if the Semente work with the Greco Agreka or with the Lower Sorbian takes hold, we can facilitate some of that back and forth some more as well.
Okay, well let's thank you,
Mary.
Mm-hmm.